Okay, we have a special guest now on the White Coat Investor podcast. We have Chad Chubb here. He's a certified financial planner and a fiduciary for physicians, dentists, and their families across the United States. He's been quoted by Medical Economics, AMA, and CNBC, and I've linked to a number of blog posts that he's written in my monthly newsletter. Chad, welcome to the White Coat Investor podcast.
Thanks, Jim. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you on here. It's really wonderful to, you know, introduce you maybe to the podcast audience that hasn't had a chance to meet you yet. You're one of my, you know, listed firms and have been for a long time on our recommended financial advisor page. But sometimes I think people don't realize that's there sometimes. So I want to make sure they're aware of that and maybe get to know you a little bit better personally today. Can you tell us to start with what made you go into financial advising? Why did you decide to become a financial advisor?
Yeah. Good question to get started. I think it was more or less a few life events led me to become a financial advisor. You know, initially, Jim, I actually thought I was going to be a sports agent. I really enjoyed sports my entire life, played a decent level of hockey at one point. And I don't know, maybe it was the Jerry Maguire effect, but it just seemed like that was such a neat way to kind of mix business with sports. And then one day I had to come to the reality that I probably would not survive law school. So ended up thinking, well, what's another way to keep sports involved? And you know, kind of the next idea was financial planning for professional athletes. So that led me to major in finance at the Smill College of Business up there at Penn State. So, you know, I think it was different life events. My father-in-law also was essentially a financial advisor for 30 years. He kind of transitioned from management a little bit in between there. But, you know, for most of his career there, he was focusing on working with physicians, both, you know, early career and late career. And watching him kind of speak at different hospitals across the central PA and even western PA and, you know, work with the PA Medical Society, that had a big effect. Just kind of seeing the work-life balance he had and the difference he was making for a lot of these physicians that I think at the time it wasn't as apparent, but looking back on it, that was one of the big events. And I was fortunate to have a great internship back in 2010 with Merrill Lynch's private wealth team. And that was my first really good example of seeing what true financial planning was. Because initially headed up to New York City, you're thinking like, oh, you know, everything's the stock floor and, you know, the commodity pits where people are screaming at each other. You just assume that's what financial planning is. And it wasn't. It was obviously a much different environment, really just seeing, you know, they had a CFP on staff, they had a CFA on staff, a big team, you know, $4 billion of assets. But that was another big event that went, like, looking back on it, I think it really pushed me towards this financial advisor role and really cemented that idea. I had a unique experience too in when I graduated Penn State. So I pretty much started building my practice right out of school. I was fortunate to have a great mentor where he allowed me to be a paraplanner, working with his high net worth and high income clients and building their financial plans while he allowed me to build my practice behind the scenes. And traditional financial planning firm back then, really, you know, working with baby boomers and pre-retirees, it really wasn't until about 2015 when our family relocated to Philadelphia that we said, let's maybe start working with this physician demographic, which only happened because we were surrounded by so many young physicians. You know, a lot of the friends we were making down there had a lot of these same things going on. Large student loan balances, buying a home, starting a family, large medical contracts. It really just all started to click then on really the niche side of that financial advising. But I think, you know, the long-winded answer there, bringing it back to the short side of things, was I think it comes back to helping, whether it's medicine, financial planning, or even, you know, going back to the initial law example there, you have that personality to help and you want to help. And numbers was always something I enjoyed as well, coming from a family of small business owners. So looking back, I think it was numerous life events and then, you know, just my love for numbers and small business owners and really just coming back to or coming from a family of small business owners that want to help. And those are kind of the different points that I look back on where I think now it makes a lot more sense on how I came down the financial advising path, kind of looking back on time there.
So you don't get to be the agent for the NHL stars, but you do get to be the agent for all these doctors out there. So you can yell at them, show me the money.
I always joke that I went from sports contracts to medical contracts. So it all worked out.
Awesome. So tell me about what's your fee structure and why did you choose that structure?
Yeah, you know, I'm happy I finally get to have this conversation with you. You know, I tell other advisors, so we use a flat fee structure. It's one of those things where it always makes me chuckle a little bit because we often, whether it's my friends that are financial advisors or other advisors meet at conferences, you know, they kind of always, you know, why do you use that model? It kind of feels like you're leaving money on the table and things of that nature. And I often reference you, Jim. I also reference Rick Ferry quite a bit. I think I just like the guys that always kind of take the other side of things and kind of challenge that status quo. But we decided to use a flat fee structure. And again, stealing words from you, that good advice at a fair price. We thought it made the most sense You know, I think it was either Andrew McFadden or possibly Daniel Wren that said it on their episode as well, just saying, you know, when you have a true niche and you work with that same group of individuals, you have a wonderful opportunity to really custom tailor that pricing structure for that demographic. And I think, you know, the way our flat fee structure is built, which is based on essentially tiers with net worth and income, we knew that we could build a very specific tailored flat fee model to work with, you know, Gen X and Gen Y physicians. So we utilized that fee structure. It wasn't always that way, but it really evolved over the past 5 years. Again, kind of just hearing the message you've always put out there, listening to the message that Rick has put out there. And again, tailoring that to the clients that we work with every single day, we were able to really custom tailor that flat fee structure.
So what is most unique about your firm? I mean, when I log on to wealthkeel.com to check it out, the thing that pops up there is financial planning for Gen X and Gen Y physicians. Does that mean you don't want to have baby boomer clients that when Gen Z comes along in a few years, when they come out of medical and dental school, you want them or you don't want them? Or what is it that's so unique about Gen X and Gen Y that you've decided to focus there?
Yeah, great question. And this kind of came back to the whole transformation that happened back in 2015. And we got to work with baby boomers, and we still do have clients that are, you know, in that retirement phase, and they trusted us since day one, and we're very happy and proud to work with them. But it came down to, you know, who do we serve best, but also who are we most relatable with? You know, who do I want to have conversations with for the next few decades? And for us, that came back to our generation. You know, I'm a millennial, but, you know, that Gen Y generation, but Gen X as well. Gen X seems to be that forgotten generation. So we wanted to make sure we gave them extra love. So, you know, if that changes for Gen Z down the road, maybe it does, Jim. Right now, I don't have any intentions of that because there's already more than enough individuals out there to keep us busy here for the foreseeable future. But we will want to continue to build that focus because, again, it's just they're relatable. You know, we're in that same phase of life. So financial planning aside, you know, we can sit there and have a conversation on the current events and growing our families and going through a lot of those life events. So I'd say that's probably the biggest unique feature. I think you hit on that flat fee structure again. And we're also very tech savvy, tech nerds on keeping a very efficient firm, but also keeping financial planning, you know, exciting. We think technology kind of removed the spreadsheets and the more boring part of financial planning that maybe we're kind of used to thinking of and making it a lot more interactive. So I think those three items are probably the big items that make us unique, which I always, you know, kind of come back and chuckle at a little bit too, because why those are huge differentiators in many worlds, you know, when you look at your list of great advisors that you have, I think that's the beauty of that list, that you're having a lot of individuals that are doing it the right way. They have the right focus. You know, they truly specialize in, you know, that group of physicians, you know, whether it's Gen X and Gen Y or maybe even the more seasoned attending physician or whatever, you know, cycle they're in there in their medical career. So I think those are the unique features of our firm at the highest level.
All right, let's get into some questions from the listeners here. Our first one comes from Robin, who's got a question about an old 457. Let's listen to that one.
Good morning. I'm a surgical subspecialist and was employed for several years by an independent small community hospital that was owned by the county. So I was able to contribute to a governmental 457 during my employment, and I maxed it out every year. I left that job a few years ago and rolled the 403b to a new account, but kept the 457 in place, mainly because of the flexibility of distributions before the age of 59. I guess I was thinking that this could be beneficial in case of emergency. At this moment, I think that hospital is still solid. They're very solvent and, as far as I know, in good shape. My question is this. If that small hospital were to be acquired by a large for-profit healthcare system, what would happen to my 457? Would it go away? Would it be subject to dissolution by whatever system was acquiring them? I am starting to think that I should roll this account over as well, just so I have more control over it. Thank you so much for everything you do. I will say that your advice has been life-changing for me and my family.
All right, Chad, what do you think about that one? What should she do with this old 457 from an old employer? She's worried about the hospital being bought out.
Yeah, very good question. You know, when I hear these messages too, it's always nice to hear the really nice words they say about you too, Jim. It shows the effect that you're having. So the first thing is that trying to plug myself in as if Robin was a client of ours, I think she is right in that thinking of having that the accessibility. But for the most part, with a 457, you know, we're going to assume it's a 457B plan coming out of the hospital side of things. few things we look at. If it's a good plan, you know, you can always keep it as is, assuming, you know, the hospital's not bought out, or if they are, you know, we'll kind of see if they kind of merge that plan, you know, looking for good investment options, making sure that it's low cost, making sure that there's good, you know, expense ratio, low expense ratio options inside of that plan. You know, with today, if she needed to, she could, Robin could also move that account over, you know, if a 401k or a 403b accepts that 457b, which, you know, at least in our experience, that's pretty common. And assuming you do have a good plan where it makes sense to convert that over, you know, that would be one idea as well. You know, with that 59 and a half, we're not as concerned about that. You know, when we build a financial plan, we try to build in these different buckets to prepare for earlier financial dependence if we do need access. But, you know, at least from our experience, you're going to max out your 403b, you're going to max out your 457b, you know, hopefully you're cranking out backdoor Roths every year, and then you probably are going to build up a pretty substantial taxable account. And if all else fails, we know that we still have access to 72Ts if needed. So I think the accessibility is a good thing to keep in mind, but I wouldn't make my decisions on that. I would make my decisions based on the plan that she has or what is possibly available to her.
Yeah, I think the big question here is that a risk for 457? I mean, the big problem with 457s is it's not your money. It's the employer's money. And so there's always this risk of the hospital or the employer, whoever it might be, going out of business. But I don't know that it just being acquired by another company is quite the same risk as going out of business. I mean, I would assume when the other company buys it, it's pretty much now the one standing behind the 457. Isn't that kind of what you would expect in that situation?
Yeah, I would as well, you know, just in listening to that piece of it. And that's why, you know, when we listened to that, the buyout part just didn't seem as concerning. Now, if she came in and said, you know, we're worried about that hospital going out of business, you know, we're located in Philadelphia where we actually saw a hospital go out of business, Hahnemann, never thought you'd see that, but it does happen. So it's definitely something to be aware of. But with the buyout, as opposed to possibly going under, I would say that most of that concern was lowered.
Yeah. All right, let's take our next question. This one comes from Dan from South Florida, who's left us a few questions on the White Coat Investor podcast, but let's take a listen to this one.
Hey, Jim. This is Dan from South Florida. I just want to say thank you for everything you've done. You really helped to change my financial life, which has led to all the other aspects of my life becoming a lot easier and less stressful, and I really appreciate that. Part of this has led to me start a side gig apart from medicine. My medicine job, I'm a 1099 independent contractor, and I'm starting this business on the side where I'll be owner and operator. My question is, it's a sole proprietorship, obviously, and I'm going to be paying myself through the business. Is it best to pay myself as a 1099 or have myself be a W-2 employee of the company that it is under so that all the taxes and everything else are taken care of that way? Not 100% sure on this, and I'm trying to figure it out online, but I appreciate your recommendations. Thanks again for everything you do.
Okay. I think Dan's a little bit confused about how this all works. You want to see if you can clear up some of that, of how this side gig is going to work?
Yeah. So listen to Dan's message there, and maybe I'm missing the deeper part of that, but I pretty much thought, you know, you could probably keep this pretty simple. For us, when we usually go through this conversation with clients on keeping things simple, 1099 is the way to go. And I think based on the way that Dan walked through that too, it seems like that is the main option too, which also provides the most flexibility. I even say a little bit more agile too. And since his current pay structure, it sounds like he noted is 1099 as well. It seems like he probably has a pretty good plan in place. Sounds like he's quite the do-it-yourselfer there. So I would assume he's already has a good plan in place to build around 1099. I wouldn't break that. I'd keep that going, at least from what I'm getting there out of Dan's message.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. What I'm not sure Dan is realizing is that it's basically the same business as his clinical work. You know, it's not like he's going to get another 401k out of this. If you've got an individual 401k from being an independent contractor at your clinical work, and then you open another business where you're the only owner, you're opening a sole proprietorship or an LLC taxed as a sole proprietorship, it's basically the same business. You know, maybe you'll use a different Schedule C on your taxes just to separate them out. And, you know, maybe you open a different bank account and that sort of stuff to separate them out. But for everything interesting about it, it's basically the same business. It's just like as if you were working for two hospitals as a 1099 independent contractor. It's just, it's more of what you're doing, even though you're doing a little bit different work. Now, if that business got big and you had a whole bunch of employees, maybe you'd want to consider, you know, incorporating and those sorts of steps. But it doesn't sound like just kind of starting a side gig that you're anywhere near that yet. So I think you're absolutely right there. All right, our next one comes from an anonymous caller. and is not actually about that caller. It's about that caller's father. So let's take a listen to that.
Hi, Dr. Daly. I would like your advice to understand the difference in strategy between these two scenarios to help give advice to my dad. If my dad retired in 2019, my assumption is that the advice would be to try and budget less than the classic 4% withdrawal rate until the market improves. However, he was planning to retire this summer. So now as the market has crashed, he is often reaching his retirement target even though he was there earlier this year. So do you still recommend retiring and going lean based on the assumption that the market would recover? Or do you say tough luck and you need to work a little longer until we start to see things rebound? Thanks again for all your help. Really appreciate all your advice.
Okay, this is a kind of a deep question, and I think it's a good question. It's what you always worry about, right? You worry about retiring right into a bear market. So what would you tell this doc and this doc's father?
Yeah, this is exactly, this is the one message you never want to hear or hear stories of. And you just kind of look back on it and you say, you're retiring at the end of 2019, even the start of 2020, man, everything's going perfect. And, you know, whether it's a market correction or what, you know, we're seeing here with a pandemic, you know, my first thought is I hope that there were some precautions put in place by hitting that retirement phase, you know, naturally lowering the risk in the allocation, things of that nature. It's such a simple question, but such a loaded question where there's so many moving parts that you could probably ask more questions on. You know, I'd even come back to, you know, how much is this individual's father, do they have a good pension? Do they have a good Social Security? Or are they truly relying on, you know, that quote unquote 4% rule out of a portfolio? That's where, you know, if that portfolio is vital and they're still pulling money out through this downturn, and, you know, hopefully we get some good news here soon. And maybe by the end of the year, we're making strides forward. But still, if it goes out for a longer period of time, you know, what type of effect does that have? You know, maybe you do discuss some type of work. Maybe it's something more simple just to at least kind of offset what you had to pull out of your portfolio. You know, we always use the example in these downturns. Long as you have all your workers going back to work for you when it does turn around, you know, you can get through that, you know, nor that modern portfolio theory idea. But I think there's just so many more questions I'd want to ask there. And then also Michael Kitches had a really good article essentially in the past, keeping more what we call core amounts in it. You know, agile amounts where you can change amounts around. That might be something they want to address in the future where, hey, we're probably going to go through these types of things in the future. Again, usually not pandemic-based, but we will go through market corrections, and just kind of having some flexibility in that number as opposed to that hard 4% rule, I think is vital. You know, whether you're just retiring or just even planning for retirement, I think that's a huge part. But I don't know, Jim, there's so many questions I want to ask there to dig deeper. But that would be my initial thinking, just kind of hearing that note from the individual there for their father.
Well, let's take it a little bit deeper, because I think this is what a lot of people think about. I think the 4% rule is super useful to kind of get a ballpark figure of about how much you need to retire. It's very helpful. You know, you reverse engineer it, you look at your expenses, you multiply them by 25. That's what financial independence is. As an actual withdrawal strategy, I think it sucks. You know, I think you're far better off if you can be somewhat flexible, you know, and actually use, you know, what's often termed a variable withdrawal strategy. When times are good, you take out a little bit more money, you buy a little nicer gifts for the grandkids, you give a little more to charity. When times are bad, you tighten the belt a little bit. I mean, you did this through your whole career. What's to keep you from doing it during retirement? So I think that's probably the best strategy for everybody, is some sort of a variable strategy. It'll allow you to spend more money throughout your career and not be, you know, railroaded into a, you know, specific 4% rule. That said, I think you really need to assume that this is going to happen the year after you retire. You know, if you go in and you have a plan that's okay, if this happens a year after you retire, you really know you're ready for retirement. And so if it does happen, that's okay. You know, I mean, most of the time, you're still investing for 20 or 30 years, and you don't have a portfolio that's 100% stocks. So you can spend from the bonds or spend from the cash for 2 or 3 or 5 years, whatever it takes to recover. And so I don't think you have to go back to work. If you had enough money to retire in January, you still have enough money to retire, you know, just because the stocks in your portfolio dropped, and who knows what it is, right? We're recording this now on what's today, the 7th or the 8th, and it's going to run the 22nd. So who knows what's going to happen between now and then. But, you know, it just because the stocks went down 20% doesn't mean that everything's changed in your life. It's like Cindy and I were talking before we started recording this podcast. We were talking about her daughter, who has a 529 plan, right? An aggressively invested 529 plan, and starts college this fall. And so she's freaking out about losing all this money, but we're looking at each other chuckling because, you know, we know something she doesn't, that she can just pay cash for what's coming up with college, and that she has time over the next 4 to 6 or 8 years or however long she spends in school for those stocks to recover. And so I think a lot of people just don't, you know, they lose the long-term perspective and realize that they don't need all of that retirement money the day they retire. You know, they're going to be taking it out over 30 years. And so it's okay to still take a long-term perspective with a significant chunk of it.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, you're going to use a variable rate, or kind of using that idea of like the core amounts and the adaptive amounts that you can move around. But we always like the idea of using that bucket mentality. We think buckets are just more relatable, but, you know, hey, this bucket is going to be ultra conservative because during your retirement, this is the first bucket we're going to exhaust. This next bucket's going to have a little bit more risk in it because we still want to keep pace with inflation, but we know that we're going to get to this bucket in the near future. This third bucket is going to have more risk. So when we go through these crazy markets, yes, it's going to bounce around a little bit more, but we know that that is very far down the timeline. So we have more time and more market cycles to get through to make sure that we're recovering that. And as that bucket shifts up, we can start to peel back some of that risk as well. And I think that's a good idea. I forget, it was a report a while ago, but essentially it was the benefits of sequence of return. And they pretty much said the first 3 years before retirement and the first 3 years after retirement are good years to make sure that you're keeping an eye on the overall risk. But once you get out of those cycles, you can start to kind of get back into that benefit of sequence of returns. I thought that was a really good, that's an idea that we utilize a lot on starting to maybe take some risk off the table headed into it, keeping it off a little bit. And then we kind of get back into that longevity play where, you know, hey, a few decades ago, you retire and maybe you have 10 years or so. Now, you know, you can retire and have a 30 or 40 year retirement depending on your longevity. And you want to make sure you're planning for that too. So I think, you know, whether it's at variable rate or even just using different buckets, I think those are two really good ideas to keep in mind for that retirement phase.
Yeah, it's the whole idea of a bond tent there where you de-risk, you know, for a few years before and after retirement. But, you know, whether you call it buckets or not, it's really the same thing, you know. And like when I helped my parents set theirs up, we basically took out, you know, 2 or 3 years of RMDs and put that in cash. You know, it's literally in cash. They cannot lose money for 2 or 3 years worth of withdrawals. And so that just gives them, I think, a lot easier time sitting back and being more philosophical in times like these. You know, it was interesting. My dad called me up a couple of weeks ago and he said, you know what? Since you started helping us with our money, we have twice as much money, even after this drop. And I'm like, you know what? It's not that complicated. You're right. That's the way it works. So, but it's just good to take the long-term perspective, I think. At any rate, Chad, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today. Those who want to get more information about you or from you, they can find that at wealthkeel.com, or they can just email you at chadchubb. That's 2 B's on the end of Chubb at wealthkeel.com. Thanks for coming on the White Coat Investor Podcast.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Jim. And as you would say, thank you for what you do. I appreciate it. Thanks, Jim.